When is a nuclear exposure threshold below which it's safe to be exposed to radiation not a nuclear exposure threshold below which it is safe to be exposed to radiation? Answer: always. Because there is never a threshold below which it is safe to be exposed to radiation. That is a known scientific fact. Now, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, was established in 1974 specifically to regulate the nuclear power industry and to protect people and the environment, not to promote the technology. But the NRC has recently been tasked by presidential executive order with enabling the building of more reactors, a position in direct opposition to what its mission is supposed to be as our hardcore last line of defense safety regulator. So when a genuine expert in radiation health hazards, someone who knows why this is not a good idea, tells you
this particular energy source is not compatible with who we are as human beings, because we as human beings, we learn by making mistakes. And you can make a mistake with wind, you can make a mistake with solar, so you lose power for a few hours, whatever. You make a mistake with nuclear, you contaminate a landmass the size of Switzerland, or worse, and you make it uninhabitable for hundreds of years, thousands of years. And we've done that over and over and over and over again with all kinds of nuclear technology, weapons, and power. And it is time that human beings recognize what technologies are compatible with who we are and what ones aren't. And nuclear power is simply not.
Well, when Cindy Folkers, radiation and health hazard specialist at Beyond Nuclear, points out the specifics of what recent executive orders mean to the work of the NRC, nuclear safety, and, well, the survival of us all, you get another look into that dark rabbit hole that leads to the awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, while Shakespeare asked what's in a name, we ask, does the addition of one word to the mission statement of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission really make that big a difference? Oh yeah. This week's special featured interview is with Cindy Folkers. She is radiation and health hazard specialist at Beyond Nuclear with close to 20 years of experience there, parsing out what the nuclear industry is actually saying and doing and what we can do about it. She walks us through what the addition of the word empowering means to the future course of the NRC and why we need to be concerned and take action. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Linda Pence-Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. Jack Cohen-Joppa of the Nuke Resistor with another story of our shared history of successful activist resistance, and more honest nuclear information than will factor into the gerrymandering redistricting battles currently being played out in the United States. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 26, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Limited time for news stories this week, So we'll start out with a story that's important to any listeners who might be in Ohio, possibly in proximity to the Wilmington presentation of my play. In Piketon, Ohio, an estimated 50,000 gallons of potentially radioactive wastewater were released on site during a demolition project at the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, a former uranium enrichment facility with a long history of toxic contamination. The release, detailed in a report filed with the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, occurred over approximately 26 hours between July 7 and July 8, 2025. According to the contractor, Fluor BWXT Portsmouth, the leak originated from a failed pipeline valve in a system designed to transfer accumulated rainwater from the demolition sites. Some of the wastewater seeped into the ground, while the rest flowed into a storm sewer that ultimately discharges into local waterways, including the Scioto River. And now, here's the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, who wants us to know that Trump will get his Russian yellow cake, if only he would eat it too.
On August 6th, we learned that U.S. President Trump had announced he would raise tariffs on India to 50%. Although Trump had already been on his tariff rampage for quite some time, this was nevertheless a somewhat surprising strike at one of the United States' largest trading partners. The reason Trump gave for this punitive action was that India was still importing 38% of its crude oil from Russia, and, quote, they don't care how many people in Ukraine are being killed by the Russian war machine. Worse still, India was selling some of the oil on the open market for profits, Trump railed. Needless to say, none of this passes the credibility test, since Trump admires nothing more than profiteers skilled at enriching themselves by any means, and he himself clearly doesn't give a tinker's cuss about the beleaguered people of Ukraine or anywhere else, including right here at home in the United States. The hypocrisy here, and yes, we knew there'd be hypocrisy in here somewhere, is that the United States still imports a cumulative 44% of its uranium concentrate, needed to fuel its domestic nuclear power plants, from Russia, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan, the latter two ostensibly independent countries, but very much under Russian influence in the energy sector, including the nuclear one. And according to 2023 figures from the Energy Information Administration, while U.S. facilities provided 28% of the uranium enrichment services purchased by U.S. owners and operators, 27% came from Russia, more than any other foreign supplier. All of this is still happening despite a law signed by President Biden in May 2024 that banned the import of low-enriched uranium from Russia, effective August 11, 2024, until it expires in 2040. However, realizing that the U.S. could not possibly replace the Russian supply overnight, the law granted a temporary waiver for Russian uranium imports, if no viable alternative sources are available, or if it is, quote, in the national interest. The waiver will end in 2028, by which time the US will supposedly be able to supply all its uranium fuel from domestic or other friendly sources. Which countries might still be categorized as friendly by then is anybody's guess, since India clearly thought it was a friend to Trump, who now seems to be flirting with its enemy, Pakistan, instead. This new capacity will happen, according to the Trump administration, due to the slew of executive orders the president released on May 23rd, designed to fast-track everything nuclear, including the production of uranium fuel. But none of this will happen overnight, and likely not by the 2028 waiver deadline either. According to 2023 figures, imports accounted for 99% of the uranium concentrate used by the US to make nuclear fuel, a total of 32 million pounds. Most of it comes from Australia and Canada, in addition to Russia, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan. But even the Trump administration isn't that confident. In the executive order addressing uranium fuel supply, it said, "To the extent feasible, the Secretary of Energy shall implement plans to ensure that a long-term supply of enriched uranium is available for the continued operation of the projects referenced in this first sentence of this subsection, including through the establishment of domestic fuel fabrication and supply chains to reduce reliance on foreign sources of fuel." To the extent feasible. And if it isn't? Watch for Trump to send new reasons to allow his friend, Russian President Vladimir Putin, to keep sending him the uranium concentrates and even the fuel he needs to fulfill his nuclear dreams. Trump will get his yellow cake, if only he would eat it, too. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, what bothers you most about nuclear, besides all of it? Is it the bombs? Forever quantities of highly radioactive waste? Radiation emissions from your neighborhood nuclear reactor? Cancer threats, birth defects, fertility issues, contamination of land that many of us live near, if not on? We can do nothing about this technology's threats to health and safety without knowing the truth about nuclear. And communicating that truth is the self-selected mandate for Nuclear Hot Seat. We provide you with the information you need to understand what's happening in the nuclear industry that is not influenced by the millions of dollars they spend on their never-ending propaganda media machine. We cover what you face in your area in terms of threats to health, welfare, and safety, and what you, what we, what any of us can do about it. And that's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We provide the kind of nuclear information that mainstream media just doesn't seem to have the heart, or time, or money, or space to put on the air or in print. Verifiable nuclear information that's been sourced, checked, and footnoted, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts. We also offer shout-outs to people on the front lines of activism around the world, their triumphs, challenges, and how you can become one of them. But we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations. And as you might expect in today's economic environment, they've recently gotten very thin. But we cannot survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, now is the time to help us out. You can make it a one-time donation or a monthly recurring. $5 a month, the same as a cup of coffee and a good tip to the barista. So buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee every month, and know that by doing so, you'll be supporting the services required to keep this program going. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or you can send money directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. So go there and donate now to help keep our nuclear news online, and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. It is proven scientific and medical fact that exposure to ionizing radiation produced by all nuclear weapons, reactors, and the processes engaged to create them is damaging to human health. But how bad can it be? Isn't there a level below which it's safe to be exposed to radiation without risking our health? If so, what might that level be? How valid are those measurements? And who decides? Today's guest will provide some clarity on current pressures on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to conform to something other than genuine safety concerns, and what this means to the future health and safety of people and the environment. Cindy Folkers is Radiation and Health Hazard Specialist at Beyond Nuclear, with close to 20 years of experience there. She is also co-author with Dr. Ian Fairley of the book, The Scientist Who Alerted Us to the Dangers of Radiation. Here, she takes us through the existential question, when is a nuclear exposure threshold not a nuclear exposure threshold? Always, because as you will hear, there is never a threshold below which it is safe to be exposed to ionizing radiation from nuclear sources. I spoke with Cindy Folkers on August 22nd, 2025. Cindy Folkers, always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much for having me again.
We're talking about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission today, and what I'd like to do is get a little bit of background on the NRC itself. When was it created, and what was it created to do?
To understand the genesis of the NRC, we have to go back to about 1946. This was after the Department of Defense had dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Of course, we just had the 80th anniversary or remembrance for that. At this time, the federal government of the United States was trying to make people in the United States more friendly or more accepting of atomic weaponry. And as a result, they thought it might be a good idea to create a new agency. And that new agency was the Atomic Energy Commission. It was formed in 1946, and it was formed to try and promote the softer side of the atomic bomb. In other words, nuclear power, something that civilians might be able to actually appreciate. Now, mind you, while all of this was going on, they were actually hiding the horrific health impacts that happened right after the bomb's flash, right, with the heat and the radiation and the people who were burned and their silhouettes were burned into the sides of buildings. I mean, it was just horrific. And they didn't want the bombs, the atomic weaponry, banned, like the chemical weaponry had been banned after World War I. And so at the same time, they were creating this new shiny agency to make new shiny proclamations about this technology and how it could be good for civilian use to create electricity. They were hiding the actual impacts of the initial impacts of the atomic bombs. And we didn't find those impacts out until decades later. So moving on to the Atomic Energy Commission, its charges were to both promote civilian nuclear power and also to regulate the same industry. So in the mid-1970s, it was decided that maybe this wasn't such a good idea, that maybe this was a conflict of interest. And as a result, they then divided the Atomic Energy Commission into the ERDA, or Energy Research and Development Administration, ERDA, and into NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at that time was tasked with protecting public health and safety related to nuclear energy. That was what they were tasked with. There is, of course, debate that they actually do that to the fullest extent. They generally do not. But the Energy Research and Development Administration, later on, a few years after its creation, became the Department of Energy. And it's important to understand that this part of the Department of Energy was meant for nuclear technology promotion, as well as some other agency functions, regulations, and nuclear weapon sites, etc. But in the history of the DOE, in their role as promoter, they, among other reasons, had an MOU issued on them in the mid-1990s.
What is an MOU?
It is a memorandum of understanding. It is often made in the federal context between agencies. And this memorandum of understanding blocked the Department of Energy from performing certain health studies. And the reason that it did that was because we in the communities that had to deal with nuclear contamination and nuclear exposures were concerned that this was a conflict of interest, the promotion, and then the Department of Energy would go on to study the people and their lived experiences who lived around these sites and any diseases that may have come from exposure to the materials at these sites and that were contaminating the environment. So this is important, and I'm bringing it up in this context because the very reason that DOE and NRC were separated out from the AEC was so that NRC could be the regulator and not the promoter. Now, it's important to understand because the NRC has also instigated and promoted sometimes studies of radiation and its impact on human health. And some of the studies they've gone through with and some of the studies that they've canceled, but this has been considered a purview of theirs. So if it were to be that the NRC would take on more of a promotional role than they already do, then that would call into question any of the health regulations or any of the health research that they might conduct. Because again, the whole reason that the Atomic Energy Commission was separated was to allow a regulator to actually regulate with the hope of some independence. And we can argue and adjudicate whether or not the NRC was good at that. But the fact is that if they change their mission toward some of the language in the executive orders, for instance, that Trump has issued with regard to nuclear power, then we have a real concern, because it could be, again, coming back around to where NRC has more of a promotional role.
Let's take a look at those executive orders and what they've done. There have been a whole slew of them since Yes. Trump took office in January. What are they, and what have they concerned, and what are the implications going forward?
The executive orders, there were five of them issued at about the same time, I think it was in May of this year, earlier this year, from the Trump administration. And these executive orders were to advance nuclear power for electricity generation. But of course, anytime you do that, we always have to have in the back of our minds the connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And more nuclear power is going to mean more access to the materials that make nuclear weapons. That's a piece to consider here. There are five main ones. The one that I am most interested in is Trump Executive Order 14300. So that's 14300, the title of which is Ordering the Reform of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now, this order does a lot of things. Overall, what it wants the NRC to do is, and I'm quoting here from the order, when carrying out its licensing and related regulatory functions, the NRC shall consider the benefits of increased availability of and innovation in nuclear power to our economic and national security, in addition to safety, health, and environmental considerations. So right away, it's putting on par with safety and health, innovations, and the benefits of increased availability. The executive order is charging the NRC to go ahead and make it easier to bring nuclear reactors for civilian energy generation online. And it continues, quote, reorganize the NRC to promote the expeditious processing of license applications and the adoption of innovative technology, end quote. This is what the executive order says overall. And I am specifically interested in Section 5B of the executive order, because what it does is it basically instructs the NRC to find a limit of radiation below which there is no damage, so that they can go ahead and set that limit for human exposure to radiation. Now, of course, there's a problem with this, which we will get to later. But I want to finish this quote from the executive order, quote, adopt science-based radiation limits. In particular, the NRC shall reconsider reliance on the linear no threshold, or LNT, model for radiation exposure as the and the as low as reasonably achievable standard, which is predicated on LNT.
So can you translate that for those of us listening who might not have been able to follow all of that gobbledygook?
Yes. There's a lot to unpack here, but the reason why Section 5B is so important is because it's going at the very heart of the model, which is the linear no threshold model, on which regulations for radiation exposure are based.
Briefly, can you explain what that model is and what it says?
The linear no threshold model is really composed of two pieces, linear and no threshold. And both of these statements go to how radiation can harm people. So it's a model to tell you how dangerous radiation may be. The linear part of the model really just says, look, if you're exposed to radiation, your risk of disease will increase proportional to the dose of radiation that you received. So it's a question of defining risk when you're exposed to radiation. That's the linear part. Now, the no threshold part basically says that there is no dose below which there will not be a risk of disease. In other words, there's no safe dose. Every dose of radiation poses a risk. Now, the problem is what the executive order is asking the NRC to do is define a threshold. And if there is no threshold, then they're asking the NRC not to be protective anymore at all. They're asking the NRC to go ahead and allow certain exposures and allow certain people to be sacrificed for this technology. So it's important to understand that the linear no threshold also is not a regulation in and of itself. It is a model on which the regulations are based. And so the NRC, as some other bodies, international regulation bodies, they sort of take that model and they tweak it and they change it little bits here and there. So it's not perfect. The model isn't perfect for the regulations. But here's the problem with the model itself. If you're looking at trying to protect people, it's important to understand that the contemporary scientific evidence shows that about half of the time, and this is contemporary scientific evidence that's come from health studies, about half the time that the linear no threshold underestimates cancer risk from low radiation exposures.
Underestimates.
Yes, yes, about half the time. And this evidence also confirms that there is not a threshold below which radiation exposure does not cause harm. So when you're looking at the most contemporary evidence, it shows that not only does the linear no threshold underestimate about half of the time what the risk is from radiation exposure at low doses, but it also reconfirms that there is no threshold. So here's the thing. And this is an interesting piece. So when you're dealing with the linear no threshold, and if there is no threshold for risk from radiation exposure, then there is no dose that can be allowed to be given to any member of the public, or for that matter, any worker. And I should say that this contemporary scientific evidence that shows this underestimation of the LNT's predictions is also primarily based on worker evidence and worker data. So that means that you don't have, it's not fully representative of impacts on females or children or pregnancy. In addition to that, these particular data that were used to see how well the LNT was measuring up as a model, these particular data also just focus on cancer disease endpoints. So nothing about genetics, nothing about pregnancy impacts, stillbirths, or inability to get and maintain a pregnancy, nothing about anything of any of that. So none of the populations or the life cycles or the people that are most susceptible to damage from radiation are fully included in the data that shows that the LNT underestimates health impacts. So the underestimation is primarily for workers, and workers are the healthiest part of the population, and they don't represent everyone.
This sounds like a setup for increased amounts of radiation exposure to be allowed, a denial of any impact, but a definite impact, because we know from studies that there is impact from radiation, especially upon, as we were talking last week with Mary Olson, women, children, especially female children, and the fetus. We're talking about the future of humanity here.
Yes, yes, we are. And they're doing it in service of trying to make the Nuclear Regulatory Commission fast track both relicensing of reactors, but specifically also increasing the number of reactors that we have for new licenses. And that would primarily be SMRs, small modular reactors, but it could be other types of reactors as well. And because they're ignoring the data that currently exists, they're missing the fact that the LNT, as they use it today and as it is currently constituted, is already not protective enough. So it's not protective enough already. And the Trump administration executive order is basically asking the NRC to make it less protective by, at very least, setting a level of radiation exposure that's allowable, which the NRC has never done. And they've never done that because we cannot find a threshold below which there is no damage. All radiation exposure risks damage to the person who receives that radiation exposure.
This relates to an overall change in wording of the mission statement of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It was initially stated that it was an independent commission to oversee nuclear energy matters, oversight of nuclear medicine, and nuclear safety and security. But now there's been an addition to the mission statement about enabling, where it says the NRC protects public health and safety and advances the nation's common defense and security by enabling the use and deployment of civilian nuclear energy technologies. And it has a bit from there. That's a big important word change. Where did that come from and how does it play out?
Well, see, that's what's interesting to me because the executive order was released and the NRC took it in a certain way. So you can tell by the language that the NRC uses in an it was an issue of an announcement of a meeting, okay? And in this announcement, they say that this executive order provides the NRC with a great opportunity to rethink its radiation protection regulatory framework to safely enable the nation's use of nuclear power. Now, that word enable in this NRC language, which they've adopted for the language that announces this public meeting, which happened on July 16th, so this already happened, is very telling because if you're trying to safely enable something, and you know that there's no threshold for damage, then you're already not safely enabling it by allowing any exposures to the public to begin with. And so when they use this word enable, that change in the word is a change in the mission of the NRC, that word enable. It carries a lot of meaning because we're already seeing that they're not enabling nuclear power safely. So when you say that they changed the mission statement, it's not necessarily that they changed the wording of the statement as it was. It's that they're viewing that word as different from what they're doing now. And they're viewing it in such a way that it will allow them to expose people to more radiation. So there's always been an enabling component to the NRC. And let's not kid ourselves about that. But here's the rub. They just confirmed, as poor as it is for a number of people in the public, for protecting a number of different people and pregnancies and females and children, for as poor as it is at protecting them, the linear no threshold still does have value. And the NRC recognized that it still has value in 2021 when they rejected a petition for rulemaking to study hormesis as the basis, and I'll define that in a second, to study hormesis as the basis for radiation regulations and not the linear no threshold. Now, hormesis as the basis means that a little radiation is not only not harmful, it is good for you. And here's the important thing. All of that scientific evidence that I was talking about before that says that the LNT is actually not protective, approximately 50%, or it doesn't reflect 50% of the risk of the data, of the health data. That same data shows absolutely no proof that there's a hormetic effect at low doses at all. So, in other words, the same data that support the LNT for 50% of the time and do not support it for the other 50% of the time is also the same data that's showing us that there's no threshold and that there's no hormetic effect at all. So, the NRC at the time that they were adjudicating this particular issue recognized that the LNT was still the best model for radiation protection. I call it radiation exposure because it's not really protection. If it were protection, they wouldn't be exposing anyone. So I'll call it radiation exposure. But NRC confirmed in 2021 that the linear no threshold was still the best model on which to base radiation regulations. And so now, with Trump's executive order, they're being asked to reevaluate something that they just did evaluate 3 or 4 years ago. And the problem with that is twofold. Number one, well, we all know that agencies don't move very quickly, right? And so 3 years ago wasn't a whole lot of time. That's number one. It took them at the time, it took them 5 years to even reach that point because the original petition for rulemakings were in 2015. So that's how long it took them to give a decision on the hormesis issue. So that's the first thing is the time lag and the long time that it takes agencies to come up with something like this or to reinstitute or to affirm is what they did. They reaffirmed the LNT. Well, here's the thing. If they're being asked to now go back and re-examine the LNT, which they've already done, the scientific evidence since then has only gotten more in favor of the fact that the LNT isn't protective enough. So if they're looking at scientific evidence, they're not going to be able to follow the letter of the executive order or the language in the executive order. There isn't a threshold, so they're not going to be able to establish a radiation limit. And re-examining the LNT is only going to push them to understand that the LNT isn't protective enough about 50% of the time.
But
if they base it on science.
That's the assumption that you and I as rational people would take with this. But there seems to be tremendous pressure for them not to look at this scientifically, not to do an objective evaluation, and instead come back on the side of the two words that I think are the worst when applied to nuclear technology, faster and cheaper. They want to make it unsafe. They don't care if it's unsafe as long as it continues to move forward and reward those political and corporate and governmental interests that want more nukes, because somewhere along the line in the equation, follow the money, somebody's getting awfully rich off of this, and it's not people like you and me or the scientists.
No. And if you look at the reasons why, I mean, you've got a lot of tech bros, or as they call them now, I guess it's an official word, broligarch. You're looking at the broligarchs and you're thinking, well, they want AI and they want data centers, and these data centers need a lot of power. And so their excuse is nuclear can give them a lot of quote unquote dependable power. You know, there's a whole bunch of literature on why that is not the case. Most recently, the jellyfish that shut down the reactor. Where was that? France?
Yes, that was in France. That's happened in other places. And Linda Pence-Gunter did a great hot story on that last week.
Yes. So the point being that it really does seem like, come hell or high water, which we're going to have a problem with both if they build more reactors, they're going to try and get this technology, and they're going to try and get it in any way they can, by hook or by crook, mostly by crook. And there's a lot of corruption, too. I mean, if you look at the companies that deal in nuclear, there's a lot of questions about, you know, double dealings and this kind of thing. And I don't focus there, but I do keep my ear to the wind. And there's a lot of stuff that goes on that just says, you know, this particular energy source is not compatible with who we are as human beings. Because we as human beings, we learn by making mistakes. And you can make a mistake with wind. You can make a mistake with solar. So you lose power for a few hours, whatever. You make a mistake with nuclear, you contaminate a landmass the size of Switzerland or worse. And you make it uninhabitable for hundreds of years, thousands of years. And we've done that over and over and over and over again with all kinds of nuclear technology, weapons, and power. And it is time that human beings recognize what technologies are compatible with who we are and what ones aren't. And nuclear power is simply not.
When you brought up about the small modular nuclear reactors, I always like to put the N word in there, nuclear, because they manipulated it so that would be invisible. They have so many manipulations around language. But two points I want to raise about this technology that's being pushed to be all these nuclear reactors in all of these places. The first is that, as we speak, none exists. They have never been built. They have never been tested. We do not know if the technology is viable or not because they haven't done it yet. So that's the first thing. They're talking in mythology right now. The other thing was a point that I find very troubling that I learned from an interview I did with Dr. Gordon Edwards, and I'll link to that episode on the page for this episode. He was talking about uranium enrichment and at what point it becomes enough to make a bomb. We were specifically focusing on Iran because they couldn't get to 80 or 90%, only to 60% enrichment. But Gordon was pointing out that that was high enough to make a bomb out of. He said, but you don't even need that much. He said, commercial nuclear reactors as they exist today only need a 5% enrichment of the fuel, and you cannot make a bomb. It just won't go critical. However, Small modular nuclear reactors need a different kind of fuel. It's called HALEU, stands for high assay low enriched uranium. And that uranium that has been enriched in this way to between 11 and 20%, which is the percentage that's necessary for small modular nuclear reactors, is enough to create a bomb. Maybe not an elegant bomb, maybe not a small bomb, but it is enough, which means that every time we put another one of these small modular nuclear reactors out into the world, as is planned to go all over the place, we are creating another target for terrorists, for bad actors, for accidents to happen, but more than anything, for the fuel to be stolen and weaponized. Every one of these has the potential to do that. And that certainly strikes me as a very difficult and dangerous position to put this planet in.
Yes, absolutely. And when you look at that from the regulatory standpoint, who's in charge of dealing with small modular nuclear reactor for the operations? What happens if the thing melts down? And what happens if you can get fuel from it? And so then you start to look at this technology, as I said at the beginning, not just as a technology that's generating power, but a technology that's generating potential for bomb material, and using that. And it just, to me, it's terrifying, because it's bad enough that we have low doses of radiation that are already not accounted for in the models that we use for health impact. And that's clear looking at the most recent scientific evidence, but also that these models don't even begin to talk about what happens when you have a dirty bomb, or what happens when you have a bomb that explodes from this nuclear material from small modular nuclear reactors, or what happens when the HALEU fuel melts down and that fuel is released. And I mean, if you're looking at the profile of that, that could very well be a different isotopic profile of concern for human health impact than the current reactors that we have, the old boiling water and pressurized water reactors that we currently have. So I just think that it's mind-boggling that when we have energy sources that are sustainable, that are cheaper, that are deployable in ways that are actually decentralized, that we would then turn back to a technology that has frankly haunted us for nearly 100 years. And if you look back at the history of the language of the regulations that deal with this technology, we have always made sure that we've talked about this technology in ways that center the need for having this technology, and there was no need, right? Instead of centering public health. So we knew in the 1940s that we had what was called a tolerance limit for radioactivity, and that there really was no tolerance limit, and that they, you know, some of the scientists started calling it an acceptable injury limit. Well, they don't call it acceptable injury limit now, but at least calling it that centered public health as the focus. Instead, what they did was they moved it from focusing on human health to what was practicable, was the language that they use. Now they use permissible, as low as reasonably achievable. Well, who defines reasonable? And how is it defined? Well, it's not human health anymore, right? That went out the window with a tolerance limit, which at least was focusing on damage to humans. Practicable isn't focusing on damage to humans. Practicable has in that mix what the industry needs to continue. So does permissible. So does ALARA. And that's why we have a linear no threshold model, which is used, but not in a way that recognizes the most powerful part of what it's saying. And the most powerful part, which has been now confirmed by scientific evidence, that there's no threshold for radiation damage. So that, to me, those points are what's really terrifying, is that we have made ourselves, our agency has made us the frog in water with this technology. We start making excuses. We start changing the language. We start allowing, it's a slippery slope. And it has been a slippery slope since the 1940s, since the construction of the bombs.
So how locked in is the NRC to this new way of approaching radiation danger, linear no threshold? And if we're not happy about this, which I know two people at least, you and me, we're not, what can we do about it?
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued a public meeting notice. The public meeting was on July 16th, so it's already passed. That public meeting also asked for public comments, which were due in the next couple of weeks following the public meeting. People gave written comments and oral comments during the meeting. They could turn in their written comments during the next couple of weeks. I submitted my comments, and I specifically focused on the fact that the LNT and the affirmation of the LNT is recently trodden ground, and that in order to do anything to rescind the LNT model in any way, they would have to not only rescind current scientific evidence or ignore it, but they would also have to rescind their own determination that they made in 2021, reaffirming the linear no threshold model. Now we are in a phase where, according to the executive order, the NRC would issue notices of proposed rulemaking effecting EFFE, effecting the revisions asked in the executive order 14300 within 9 months of the date of the order. Now, that's a proposed rulemaking. Now, when you have a proposed rulemaking, there are public comments that go along with that, and there may even be meetings, but there are certainly public comments. It would be published in the Federal Register. I just checked the Federal Register just before this interview. I do not see anything that says that the NRC has put any sort of proposed rulemaking in on this. But I feel like I just need to continue to search, because the way that the Federal Register is set up, it can be very difficult to find what you need. So that was 9 months that the proposed rulemaking, 9 months from the date of the order coming out, that the proposed rulemaking would have to be issued. Then the NRC shall issue final rules and guidance to conclude this revision process within 18 months of the date of the executive order 14300. And I, again, have not seen any petition for rulemaking or proposed rulemaking or anything from the side of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which would be a proposed rulemaking, that they have issued yet on which we can comment. So people just have to stay tuned. If they, you know, haven't signed up for the Beyond Nuclear Bulletin, it will be in the bulletin when something like this happens. We're on Blue Sky, beyondnuclear.org. Our website is beyondnuclear.org. Please follow us, because anything that has to do with commenting on this executive order and any sort of revision of the LNT, we're going to be following it. So if you want to stay up to date, come and visit us on Blue Sky and on our website and sign up for our bulletin. We send it out once a week.
I have relied on that bulletin for many years for information that is crucial to the running of this show. Cindy, as this continues to evolve, another thing that people can do is sign up for Nuclear Hot Seat to get each week's show. Because whenever you've got something to report, shoot me an email, send me a message, give me a text. We'll get you on the show and allow you to update this so we know exactly where we stand, what's going on, and most importantly, what we can do about it.
Right. And I would actually, at this point, say, even if there is not a Federal Register notice yet, for people who know about radiation and health and who feel comfortable writing about it, put down your thoughts right now. I mean, we know what we need to say. The LNT isn't protective enough, but the LNT is better than anything that is going to increase our radiation exposure. It's a very, very simple message, and it's a very simple message that we should all be getting out on social media, in our newsletters, and on shows like yours, even if they haven't issued a proposed rulemaking. We do not have to wait. We can stake our ground and our position now and repeat it and keep repeating it, because there's one thing that the administration understands. It's repetition, repetition, repetition. And that probably is the only way that we're going to get through.
All you social media experts out there in our community, you've got your marching orders, and we will continue to keep you up to date. For now, Cindy Folkers, this was so much more elaborate in terms of the information than I expected coming into this interview. And I thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much, Libby.
Cindy Fokers. She is Radiation and Health Hazard Specialist at Beyond Nuclear and co-author with Dr. Ian Fairley of the book, The Scientists Who Alerted Us to the Dangers of Radiation. Note that the graph she talked about was created by David Richardson. Cindy wanted to make it clear that when she talked in the interview about the linear no-threshold model, underestimating cancer risk about half the time, those are her words and thoughts regarding the graph, not David's. And my apologies, I need to get permission from David Richardson to post that graph on the Nuclear Hot Seat site along with his explanatory languaging, but that's just something that fell through the cracks this week. When I have it, I'll post it.
Activists, shout out.
Yeehaw! In just 2 weeks, my play, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due, will receive its first public performance, a staged reading, as a featured presentation of Ohio's Wilmington College Peace Resource Center's 50th anniversary celebration. The Peace Resource Center is the only archive in America devoted exclusively to the atomic bombings of Japan 80 years ago, and the play's inclusion as an official part of this celebration is a tremendous honor. There has already been a lot of media attention. Award-winning environmental journalist Carl Grossman wrote a terrific story that has been showing up all over the place. I will link to it on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 739. And there are other podcasts, articles, even a cable TV show that are in the pipeline as well. So that you know what we're dealing with here, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due is an Oppenheimer-adjacent true story of media manipulation at the dawn of the atomic age and the New York Times reporter who sold his soul to get the story. It asks and answers the question, how do you hide a nuclear bomb blast in plain sight? The production at Wilmington is currently in rehearsal for its presentation in 2 weeks on Tuesday, September 9 at 7:30 p.m., in the 400-seat Highland Theater on the Wilmington College campus. Sorry, it won't be live-streamed, so you've got to be there in person in order to watch, at least for now. Admission is free, and it's festival seating, so come early and grab a good one. I will be there. The wild horses do not exist that could keep me away. And if there's time after the presentation, I'll be on stage for a discussion with the audience. So if you can be there, please do. Come on down. I'd love to share this experience with you. And if you're willing to help me get the word out further, especially to theaters, activist groups, and anyone in the media, please copy and paste from the website and send it around. Now, here with another story of heroism in the fight against nuclear weapons is Jack Cohen-Joppa of the Nuclear Resister.
Every August, the anniversaries of the atomic bombings beckon us to honor the victims and renew our demand. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, never again. 40 years after the bombings in 1985, the nuclear arms race had reached a crescendo. Popular movements in the U.S. and Europe sought to mute the nuclear threat. Protest and nonviolent resistance had become as much a part of commemorating the atomic anniversaries as prayer vigils, floating lanterns, and folded paper cranes. For that 40th anniversary, two major public art events also brought international attention to the issue. First was the ribbon. On Sunday, August 4th, a human chain holding 15 miles of colorful fabric panels stretched from the Pentagon across the Potomac and through Washington, D.C. Thousands of the handmade panels had been gathered from all 50 states and overseas, each decorated to show what the maker loved most and wanted to protect by abolishing nuclear weapons. And even this fabric folk art caused some good trouble. In late July, the Montana State coordinator of the ribbon had been arrested after he and a colleague hung 18 panels made by Montanans on the security fence surrounding a nuclear missile silo in their state. The second public art event was the International Shadow Project, and its worldwide premiere under moonlight on the eve of Hiroshima Day. By dawn on August 6th, 10,000 volunteers in over 300 cities and towns around the globe had used whitewash, chalk, or paint on city streets, sidewalks, and public buildings to create human and animal silhouettes, recalling the haunting images that remained when lives were vaporized by the atomic blasts. Not surprisingly, the After Hours Art Project attracted some unwanted attention, and more than 200 people were arrested in 21 American towns, plus another 200 arrests reported from Canada, England, and Australia. Over the next few days, another 450 people would be arrested during more than 30 civil disobedience actions across North America. Many of these actions featured die-ins and dramatizations of a nuclear attack. On the Santa Monica Boardwalk, in front of the RAND Corporation, 200 people counted down to the launch of two watermelons, painted silver, and named Fat Man and Little Boy after the original bombs. And as these melon bombs hit the ground and exploded, whistles blared, flour and ash were thrown into the air, and the intersection filled with dying activists. 20 were arrested, including 5 charged with felony conspiracy to start a riot. In 85, nuclear weapons were still being tested at the Nevada test site. 8 national religious peace groups shepherded more than 500 people into this nuclear wilderness for the August Desert Witness to demand the U.S. ratify the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. 4 days of legal vigils and civil disobedience actions led to another 120 arrests for trespass. Local groups also took action, leading to arrests at nearly a dozen different nuclear contractors across the country. At a GTE facility in Westboro, Massachusetts, 9 people were charged on August 9th after they held photos of Hiroshima and Nagasaki victims, then knelt in prayer and blocked the entrance. They agreed to a bench trial that very afternoon and were found guilty, whereupon 7 refused to pay fines and immediately served up to 10 weeks in the county jail. Arrests were also made at nuclear military bases in at least 9 states, including Pease Air Force Base in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. There, 50 people rallied in support of 5 who walked across the line in protest. Police made no effort to stop 2 of them as they kept walking up to the monument that honors the Air Force unit that dropped the bombs on Japan. The monument itself, it's a grotesque celebration of the atomic pyre. The mushroom cloud cast in bronze, but now lifted by wings spreading wide above a granite plinth. The activists opened a large white box and ceremoniously poured ashes over the monument, then stood for a moment in the silence of the billowing cloud before their arrest. These hallowed August days are still commemorated each year with acts of anti-nuclear civil disobedience. Recently, on the 80th anniversaries, arrests have been reported during peaceful protests at Livermore Nuclear Lab in California, Lockheed Martin's corporate office in Pennsylvania, and at the Pentagon. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat, sharing more stories from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
Jack Cohen-Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 26, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email each week, it's the easiest way to guarantee that you don't miss a single episode. And it's a snap to do. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. There will be a big yellow box that pops up. You cannot miss it. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one email with a link to that week's show and a brief rundown of some of its content. If you listen to a lot of podcasts, you can also sign up on your favorite podcast channel because we are everywhere. Now, help us be in your area. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, always, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount is appreciated and will really help us out. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you the Faustian bargain with nuclear is that you get electricity for a minute and radioactive waste forever. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.